You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Black Experience Hour. This is a weekly program bringing articles of interest from a variety of sources. Your reader's name is Susan Shirey. This is being recorded for the listening week that begins March 1st. Opening with an article from the New York Times. This was posted February 1st. This year, written by Anna Coday. It says, Anna Coday reported from Carter G. Woodson's office home in Washington. Title, The Home of Carter G. Woodson, the Man Behind Black History Month. Dr. Woodson's house, the birthplace of the annual month, was a hub of scholarship, bringing together generations of intellectuals, writers, and activists. The origins of Black History Month can be traced back nearly 100 years to an unassuming three-story brick row house in Washington. In 1922, Carter G. Woodson, known as the father of Black History, bought the home at 1538 9th Street Northwest for $8,000. The home served as the headquarters for the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, parentheses, which is now known as the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, ASALH. It was where he ran the Associated Publishers, the publishing house focused on African American culture and history at a time when many other publishers wouldn't accept works on the topic. It's where the Journal of Negro History and the Negro History Bulletin were based, and it's where he initiated the first Negro History Week, precursor to the Black History Month, in 1926. Quote, if a race has no history, if it has no worthwhile tradition, it becomes a negligible factor in the thought of the world, and it stands in danger of being exterminated. Dr. Woodson famously wrote, end quote, the site, owned by the National Park Service, is being restored and will likely be open to visitors starting this fall, said a spokesperson for the Park Service. Though Dr. Woodson was the kind of neighbor who doted on children playing in the street and his stoop, even as other adults told them to behave, 1538 9th Street Northwest was more about his life's work than serving as a traditional residence. It became known as Dr. Woodson's, quote, office home, as Willie Leanna Miles, who was a managing editor of the Associated Publishers, put it in her 1991 article titled Dr. Carter Goodwin Woodson, Godwin Woodson, as I recall him, 1943 to 1950. The article was published in the Journal of Negro History, which was founded by Dr. Woodson and is still running as the Journal of African American History today. Over the years, the office home became an important nexus point for the Black History movement, and stepping through its doors was a rite of passage for many Black scholars, writers, and activists to seek Dr. Woodson's mentorship, work there, or at least pass through. Mary McLeod Bethune, Lorenzo J. Green, Lawrence Dunbar Reddick, John Hope Franklin, Langston Hughes, and many more all spent time in the home. Even after Dr. Woodson died in his bedroom on the third floor in 1950, ASILH remained based there until 1971. In 1976, the same year that Negro History Week officially grew into Black History Month, the office home was designated as a National Historic Landmark. As the years went by, it fell into disrepair. In 2005, the National Park Service purchased it along with two neighboring houses for $1.3 million, and is now working on restoring the building and creating a welcome center. Neighborhood roots. Born in 1875, Dr. Woodson, who was a descendant of slavery, worked as a coal miner, a teacher, and a school principal. Eventually, he became the second African-American to earn a Ph.D. at Harvard, the first being W.E.B. Du Bois. When Dr. Woodson bought the Row House in Washington, he, quote, wanted his organization to have a national stature, and that led him to the nation's capital, end quote, said Vincent Weiss, one of the planning leads for the Park Service's restoration project. Shaw, where the office home is situated, was at the time a predominantly black neighborhood, quote, like the Harlem of Washington, D.C., said Mr. Weiss. It was home to Howard University, quote, Black Broadway, as well as a black YWCA, where Dr. Woodson would often have lunch. In more recent years, Shaw has been a hotspot for trendy shops and white millennial residents. The median home sale price in Shaw and Logan Circle, the adjacent neighborhood, for December was nearly $750,000, according to Redfin. Ella McCall Hagen sharply remembers what Shaw used to be like during Dr. Woodson's time. Miss Hagen, a clinical social worker who is now in her 80s, lived down the street from the office home when it was a thriving intellectual and cultural hub for black minds. Shaw, quote, was like a village, said Miss Hagen. Everyone knew everyone, end quote. Dr. Woodson was known among the children primarily for handing out treats. Miss Hagen said, quote, the candy store was right by his house and it was black owned. Woodson would buy candy and give it to us. He was amazing, but we didn't realize this until we got in elementary school, and they would have Black History Week in February. Some of the kids that lived on the block, we were in the same grade. We said, that's Mr. Woodson? And that's when we really found out exactly who he was, end quote, from Miss Hagen. Miss Hagen and the other kids would often get scolded by other adults for sitting on Dr. Woodson's steps. But she recalled one time she went inside, and the image of all the various books and printed materials made an imprint on her. She said, quote, when you went in his house, he had it set up, I remember, with the books and the pamphlets and stuff he created. They used to be laying on the counter. It didn't register at the time, but later on it did. There was always a burning desire for me to get an education, end quote. She came to appreciate his presence in her neighborhood even more deeply and said, you would think, he's been to Harvard and all that stuff, that he would be somewhere else. But he wasn't. He was right there. A training ground. Today, a sign on the home's facade reads, Association for Study of Negro Life and History, Incorporated, and Associated Publishers, Incorporated. The interior is still unfurnished, but the original spiral staircase has been restored and installed. Mr. Weiss pointed out that the higher up you go in the building, the more intimate the spaces get. The first floor, where the secretaries worked, was very public, open to customers and visitors. It was also, quote, where order and shipping, processing of the Negro History Bulletin and the Journal of Negro History and other miscellaneous clerical work was accomplished, end quote, Ms. Miles wrote in her article. Quote, one never got the idea that the boss would ask you to do anything that he would not do himself, wrote the poet Langston Hughes in a 1950 article in the Negro History Bulletin. Hughes, who worked there in the mid-1920s, wrote that his job was to open the office in the mornings, keep it clean, wrap and mail books, assist in answering the mail, read proofs, bank the furnace at night when Dr. Woodson was away. He also recalled one instance of sneakily playing cards in the first floor shipping room with some other colleagues when Dr. Woodson came home earlier than expected from a trip. He said nobody got fired. Instead, he requested our presence in his study, where he gave us a long and very serious talk on our responsibilities to our work to history and to the Negro race, wrote Hughes of the incident. Para G. Doug Bovee, a former editor of the Journal of African American History and a distinguished professor of history at Michigan State University, said, quote, that some people considered the home to be kind of like a training ground for future historians and scholars of the Black experience. At one point, Dr. Woodson hosted an exhibition of art from Benin in the office home. Dr. Doug Bovee pointed out, quote, he always wanted people to come and use the resource that was available, end quote. The second floor housed Dr. Woodson's study and archives, which are now part being held by the, which are now in part held by the Library of Congress. This floor is also where he would mentor the next generation of Black historians and scholars. Quote, my workspace assignment was in Dr. Woodson's library, second floor front, opposite the staircase leading to the third floor. This allowed me an opportunity to hear conversations from his office. He seldom missed telling a visitor about the fact that he was once a coal miner and once earned a living as a garbage collector, wrote Ms. Miles, the managing director of the Associated Publishers. The third and most private floor is where Dr. Woodson slept. It's also where he died of a heart attack in 1950. But his impact continued to grow posthumously. Negro History Week became Black History Month. ASALH is still active, and many of Dr. Woodson's mentees went on to become distinguished scholars in their own right. For Miss Hagen, as life carried on, Dr. Woodson was always in the back of her mind. She was homeless at one point and had to drop out of school, but her memories of Dr. Woodson made her want to persevere and eventually finish her education. She received her master's degree in social work from the Catholic University of America in 1977. Miss Hagen said, quote, I thought about Dr. Woodson, I thought about him, and I said, Dr. Woodson, I did it. The next reading comes from a slideshow offered by TheRoot.com, put together by Jessica Washington. Here are the Black facts they didn't teach you at school. Yes, we're getting into Henrietta Lacks, George Washington Carver, Hattie McDaniel, and more. I won't describe all of these pictures, but the first one is a photo of George Washington Carver standing between Henry Ford and his son, Edsel Ford. The caption says, Ford opens food laboratory, Dearborn, Michigan. Henry Ford left and son Edsel greet Dr. George Washington Carver, noted Negro scientist from Tuskegee Institute, who came to Dearborn to receive from the motor magnate a gift of a modern, fully equipped laboratory for food research and experiments in which Dr. Carver has been particularly interested for nearly half a century. Sandwiches and salads made by the scientist from weeds and wild vegetables were served to guests. It does not tell me what that was originally published in, but clearly that's a picture from an old article. Oh, and let me take a moment to apologize. My memory tells me that I mispronounced Tuskegee earlier. Gosh. In any case, here is what we have, a little blurb on this. Black history is full of hidden secrets and figures. For example, did you know George Washington Carver's inventions were actually so much more remarkable than peanut butter? Here are a few of our favorite facts and historics that you probably didn't learn about in history class. The light bulb. Did you know that Lewis Howard Latimer invented a carbon filament that allowed light bulbs to last significantly longer than the paper in Thomas Edison's design, leading to the modern light bulb we use today? Next, George Washington Carver. George Washington Carver was a brilliant Black scientist who, unlike the story goes, did not invent peanut butter. He did, however, invent hundreds of uses for peanuts and revolutionized agricultural practices across the United States. The Ironing Board. Sarah Boone, B-O-O-N-E, a black woman, invented the ironing board. Phyllis Wheatley was the first African American to write and publish a poetry book. Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson were critical to the United States' first successful space launch, and they are known as the Hidden Figures, the real Hidden Figures. Carter G. Woodson and Black History Month. He sparked the impetus for Black History Month with Black History Week, which coincided with Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln celebrations. Brian Gumbel, if you don't know this broadcaster, you should. In 1981, Brian Gumbel made history as the first black person to host a network morning show as host of the Today Show. He was the host for years until moving on to become a brilliant sports journalist. Fun black history fact, Juneteenth doesn't celebrate Emancipation Day. Black Texans created Juneteenth to celebrate the freeing of slaves in Texas. Hattie McDaniel and the first Oscar. In 1940, Hattie McDaniel became the first black person to win an Oscar for her performance in Gone with the Wind. Traffic lights. Did you know traffic lights were invented by a black woman named Marie Van Britton Brown? Henrietta Lacks was a young black mother who received treatment for cervical cancer. Without her consent, researchers studied her cells, which ended up playing a crucial role in the study and development of countless treatments and vaccines, including the COVID-19 vaccine. Althea Gibson. We've all heard of Serena Williams, but Althea Gibson should be a household name too, as the first black tennis player to win a Grand Slam. The first African-American woman self-made millionaire, Madam C.J. Walker, was the first African-American woman to become a self-made millionaire after creating her own line of hair products. The first African-American gold medalist. In 1908, John Taylor became the first African-American to win a gold medal at the Olympics by winning the 4x400 meter relay. That's possibly supposed to read the 400 meter relay. The first black woman gold medalist. In 1948, Alice Coachman became the first black woman to win a gold medal for doing the high jump. NFL history. In 1920, Bobby Marshall and Fritz Pollard became the first black men to play in the NFL. Pollard went on to become the first black coach of the NFL. Next, turning to some recent news. This from the Denver Post. It was published February 27th by Katie Langford. Following up from an earlier news piece, artwork stolen from Denver's Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial recovered after being sold as scrap metal. Additional pieces were stolen from Joseph Addison Thatcher Memorial Fountain in City Park were also recovered. Bronze artwork stolen from the Martin Luther King Jr. I Have a Dream Memorial in Denver City Park were recovered by police after being sold as scrap metal, officials announced Tuesday. Investigators found 7 additional bronze pieces stolen from the Joseph Addison Thatcher Memorial Fountain in City Park, while recovering the 3 pieces from the MLK Memorial from a local business on Friday. All of the recovered pieces were returned to Denver Arts and Venues, which manages the monuments, The large plaque that was stolen from the MLK memorial was cut into four pieces before being sold, according to the department. Denver police say two men were involved in the thefts, including one they identified as a 67-year-old Herman Duran. They did not identify the other suspect, but are searching for both men, said police officials Tuesday. The department did not provide identifying information for either man, but in photos distributed by police, Duran appears to be white with long dark brown or black hair that is graying. The second man also appears to be white and middle-aged, with dark brown hair and brown eyes. The vandalism and theft of the I Have a Dream Memorial was first discovered by City Parks maintenance staff on February 21st, but investigators later determined the pieces were stolen between 3:30 and 5:30 a.m. February 18th. It is not clear when the pieces were stolen from the Thatcher Memorial Fountain, and there are still several pieces that have not been recovered. Police did not know about the additional theft from the memorial fountain before finding the stolen works, said the agency. Denver police initially investigated the Martin Luther King Jr. memorial vandalism as a bias-motivated crime. However, investigators now believe the theft was not motivated by bias because the pieces were sold as scrap metal, said officials on Tuesday. Anyone with information about this case may call Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. Next piece comes from the New York Times. It was posted February 26, written by Joseph Goldstein. $1 billion donation will provide free tuition at a Bronx medical school. Ruth Gottesman, a longtime professor at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, is making free tuition available to all students going forward. The 93-year-old widow of a Wall Street financier has donated $1 billion to a Bronx medical school, the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, with instructions that the gift be used to cover tuition for all students going forward. The donor, Ruth Gottesman, is a former professor at Einstein, where she studied learning disabilities, developed a screening test, and ran literacy programs. It is one of the largest charitable donations to an educational institution in the United States, and most likely the largest to a medical school. The fortune came from her late husband, David Gottesman, known as Sandy, who was a protege of Warren Buffett and made an early investment in Berkshire Hathaway, the conglomerate that Mr. Buffett built. The donation is notable for not only for its staggering size, but also because it is going to a medical institution in the Bronx, the city's poorest borough. The Bronx has a high rate of premature deaths and ranks as the unhealthiest county in New York. Over the past generation, a number of billionaires have given hundreds of millions of dollars to better-known medical schools and hospitals in Manhattan, the city's wealthiest borough. Dr. Gottesman said her donation would enable new doctors to begin their careers without medical school debt, which often exceeds $200,000. She also hoped it would broaden the student body to include people who could not otherwise afford to go to medical school. While her husband ran an investment firm, First Manhattan, Dr. Gottesman had a long career at Einstein, a well-regarded medical school, starting in 1968 when she took a job as director of psychoeducational services. She has long been on Einstein's board of trustees and is currently the chair. In recent years, she has become close friends with Dr. Philip Ozua, the pediatrician who oversees the medical college and its affiliated hospital, Montefiore Medical Center, as the chief executive officer of the health system. That friendship and trust loomed large as she contemplated what to do with the money her husband had left her. In an interview on Friday at the Einstein campus in the Morris Park neighborhood, Dr. Ozua and Dr. Gottesman spoke about the donation, how it came together, and what it would mean for Einstein medical students. The friendship. In early 2020, the two sat next to each other on a 6 a.m. flight to West Palm Beach, Florida. It was the first time they had spent hours together. They spoke about their childhoods, hers in Baltimore, his, some 30 years later, in Nigeria, and what they had in common. Both had doctorates in education and had spent their careers at the same institution in the Bronx, helping children and families in need. Dr. Ozua described moving to New York, not knowing a single person in the state, and spending years as a community doctor in the South Bronx before ascending to the top of the medical school. Leaving the airport, Dr. Ozua offered his arm to Dr. Gottesman, not quite 90 then. As they approached the curb, she waved him off and told him to watch your own step, he recalled with a chuckle. Within a few weeks, the coronavirus brought the world to a grinding halt. Dr. Gottesman's husband, in his 90s, became ill with the new pathogen, and she had a mild case. Dr. Ozua sent an ambulance to the Gottesman home in Rye, New York, to bring them to Montefiore, the Bronx's largest hospital. In the weeks that followed, Dr. Ozua began making daily house calls in full protective gear to check in on the couple as Mr. Gottesman recovered. He said, quote, "That's how the friendship evolved. I spent probably every day for about 3 weeks visiting them in Rye." End quote. About 3 years ago, Dr. Ozua asked Dr. Gottesman to head the medical school's board of trustees. She had done the job before, but given her age, she was surprised. The gesture reminded her of the fable about the lion and the mouse, and she told Dr. Ozua at the time, explaining that when the lion spares the mouse's life, the mouse tells him, quote, "Maybe someday I'll be helpful to you." In the story, the lion laughs haughtily. "But Phil didn't go, ha 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 ha," she noted with a smile. The money. Dr. Gottesman's husband died in 2022 at age 96. She recalled, quote, "He left me, unbeknownst to me, a whole portfolio of Berkshire Hathaway stock. The instructions were simple. Do whatever you think is right with it," she recalled. It was overwhelming to think about, so at first she didn't. But her children encouraged her not to wait too long. When she focused on the bequest, she realized immediately what she wanted to do. She recalled, quote, "I wanted to fund students at Einstein so that they would receive free tuition," she said. "There was enough money to do that in perpetuity," she said. Over the years, she had interviewed dozens of prospective Einstein medical students. Tuition is more than $59,000 a year, and many graduated with crushing medical school debt. According to the school, nearly 50% of its students owed more than $200,000 after graduating. At most other New York City medical schools, less than 25% of new doctors owed that much. Almost half of Einstein's first-year medical students are New Yorkers, and nearly 60% are women. About 48% of current medical students at Einstein are white, 29% are Asian, 11% are Hispanic, and 5% are Black. Not only would future students be able to embark on their careers without the debt burden, but she hoped that her donation would also enable a wider pool of aspiring doctors to apply to medical school. She said, quote, "We have terrific medical students, but this will open it up for many other students whose economic status is such that they wouldn't even think about going to medical school. That's what makes me very happy about this gift," she added. "I have the opportunity not just to help Phil, but to help Montefiore and Einstein in a transformative way. And I'm just so proud and so humbled, both, that I could do it." End quote. Dr. Gottesman went to see Dr. Ozua in December to tell him that she would be making a major gift. She reminded him of the lion and mouse story. This, she explained, was the mouse's moment. She asked, quote, "If someone said, 'I'll give you a transformative gift for the medical school,' what would you do?" Dr. Asua said there were probably three things. "One," he began, "you could have education be free." She said, "That's what I want to do." He never mentioned the other ideas. Dr. Gottesman sometimes wonders what her late husband would have thought of her decision. She says with a chuckle, I hope he's smiling and not frowning, but he gave me the opportunity to do this, and I think he would be happy. I hope so. Einstein will not be the first medical school to eliminate tuition. In 2018, New York University announced it would begin offering free tuition to medical students, and they saw a surge in applications. The name. Dr. Gottesman was reluctant to attach her name to her donation. She said, "Nobody needs to know." But Dr. Asua insisted that others might find her life inspiring. He said, "Here's somebody who is totally dedicated to the welfare of others and wants no accolades, no recognition." Dr. Asua noted that the going price for getting your name on a medical school or hospital was perhaps a fifth of Dr. Gottesman's donations. Cornell Medical College and New York Hospital now include the surname of Sanford Weill, the former head of Citigroup. New York University's Medical Center was renamed for Ken Langan, a co-founder of Home Depot. Both men donated hundreds of millions of dollars. But it is a condition of Dr. Gottesman's gift that the Einstein College of Medicine not change its name. Albert Einstein, the physicist who developed the theory of relativity, agreed to confer his name on the medical school, which opened in 1955. The name, she noted, could not be beat. Quote, "We've got the gosh darn name. We've got Albert Einstein." Following that up directly, Black Men in White Coats, the organization empowering black kids to become doctors. This comes from a news source called Nice News, and it was published February 13th, written by Rebecca Brandis. In 2018, black men accounted for only 2.6% of physicians in the United States, despite black Americans comprising 12.8% of the population. What's more shocking, however, is that the former figure showed no, quote, statistically significant difference from what it was in 1940, according to a study out of UCLA, meaning no progress has been made in nearly 80 years. That's where Black Men in White Coats comes in. The organization was founded in 2013 by Dr. Dale Okorodudu, a pulmonary and critical care physician, following a report from the Association of American Medical Colleges that showed the number of black men applying to medical schools was decreasing. Quote, "Black men are extremely intelligent, extremely savvy, extremely innovative, and can be strong leaders when given the opportunity. This is a population with phenomenal potential that is being underutilized," end quote, said Okorodudu, adding, quote, "We as black male physicians must represent our fields with integrity and pride in order to establish a strong legacy for our sons. When they thrive, we all thrive." On a mission to inspire and empower black youths through mentorship and exposure, Black Men in White Coats started with a short docu-series highlighting black doctors working at different hospitals and medical centers across the U.S. In the videos, the physicians explain what they do and why they're passionate about it, allowing young people a front-row seat to the positive impact those professionals are making in the world. Quote, "There are any given number of fantastic and amazing role models that suggest a young African-American male can be a basketball player or a football player," says Duke University neurobiologist Dr. Kafui Ziraza in one episode of the series. explaining that the same can't be said of black men in the medical field. He continues, quote, I think having a picture of what your life can look like is a powerful motivating factor, end quote. Today, the organization has expanded to include a podcast and locally organized youth summits around the country, which invite young people to get involved and interact with mentors and role models. Quote, it's cool to see African-American doctors, because you don't usually see that when you walk into a hospital, middle schooler Zim Jackson, a straight-A student, told CBS News during a summit held last April at Merritt College in Oakland, California. Okorududu added, even if they don't choose to become doctors, we are here to help them become successful in life, period. The mission to get more black men into white coats is also driven by the fact that black men have the second lowest life expectancy in the country, and studies suggest that increased racial diversity in the medical field can lead to more positive outcomes for those being treated, particularly for patients of color. Quote, what we've learned over the years is that the earlier people get introduced to healthcare careers, the more likely it is that they will enter healthcare careers. That was Dr. Peter Igarashi, Dean of the Renaissance School of Medicine at Stony Brook University, speaking at a 2023 youth summit. He went on, The most important goal today is to promote a diverse healthcare workforce, and the reason for that is that very diverse healthcare teams outperform teams that are not as diverse, end quote. Black Men in White Coats has also produced a feature-length documentary film. They provide a link if you are interested in that film or how to get that to play at a local organization you may be affiliated with, and that is trailer.bmwcmovie.com. That's all one word, bmwcmovie.com. Also, they give a link for events at Black Men in White Coats, which would be bmwcevents.com. Next, I turn to the Wall Street Journal print edition from Saturday, Sunday, February 24th, 25th, from their book reviews, Fighting for Freedom, written by Amanda Brickell Bellows, on the book Combi by Etta L. Fields Black. Millions of tourists flock to the South Carolina Lowcountry each year, drawn to the region's beaches, salt marshes, and warm weather. They spend time on the islands of Hilton Head and Kiowa, where world-famous golf courses host PGA events. But few visitors realize their proximity to the site of the largest slave rebellion in American history. In her groundbreaking book, Combi, Etta Fields Black tells the rousing story of the Union Army's Combahee River Raid, which led to the liberation of hundreds of enslaved African Americans in 1863. Skillfully using pension files and planter records, Miss Fields Black, a professor of history at Carnegie Mellon University, recovers the lives of, quote, the Combahee freedom seekers through multiple sets of transactions, end quote, records of slave sales, Confederate compensation affidavits, and land purchases. Combi begins in the Lowcountry, where thousands of enslaved African Americans once worked on the rice plantations that lined the Combahee River. From the late 1600s through the Civil War, their labor enriched generations of planter families. Conditions were grim and mortality rates were high. In the swampy, malaria-ridden area, colon, Only one-third of all enslaved children reached the age of 15 on rice plantations like those of the Combahee. To better understand her historical subjects, who later called themselves Combi, Miss Fields Black immersed herself in the environment of the lower Combahee River, where alligators and water snakes abound. Site visits and boat trips helped her, quote, see the raid from the perspectives of the enslaved people who were working in the rice fields, test many theories, and measure the distances the enslaved people and U.S. Army soldiers had to travel, end quote. Rice plantation slavery in the Low Country differed from other types of pre-war slavery. On the eastern shores of Maryland's Chesapeake Bay, for instance, enslaved African Americans began growing another cash crop, tobacco, during the late 17th century. Winters were colder and the farms were smaller than the plantations of the Low Country. It was in Maryland's Dorchester County that Araminta Ross, later known as Harriet Tubman, was born to enslaved parents in 1822. In Combi, Miss Fields Black effectively weaves Tubman's impressive biography into the author's broader narrative. Although she grew up far from the Combahee River, Tubman would change the lives of the enslaved African Americans there. In 1849, she escaped from slavery by charting a path from the Choptank River through Maryland and Delaware to the Free State of Pennsylvania. Remarkably, she faced the threat of capture by returning to Maryland about a dozen times to liberate more than 60 friends and family members. Tubman was one of the only formerly enslaved women to risk her freedom so that others could be free. Miss Fields Black noted, by returning to a slave state. The fight over slavery's future in the U.S. came to a head on April 12, 1861, when Confederate forces attacked Charleston's Fort Sumter. In July of that year, 11 states had seceded from the U.S. to form the Confederate States of America. Union and Confederate troops battled during the months ahead, but no victor emerged. To improve Union prospects, President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, but slaveholders along the Combahee River ignored the document. Less than 6 months after the proclamation took effect, the Union Army conducted an audacious raid targeting the Combahee River rice plantations, which were then, quote, considered a breadbasket of the Confederacy, according to Miss Fields Black. To achieve its mission, ruining rice crops and other agricultural capacity, destroying other capital and infrastructure, and not least, striking a devastating blow to Confederate morale. The Union relied on the crucial work of Tubman, who commanded 8 or 9 men to gather intelligence. She had reached Union-held territory in Beaufort, South Carolina, the previous year, where she aided African Americans living in refugee camps. There, she had gained the trust of many people, some of whom had escaped from those same Combahee rice plantations. Tubman shared their concerns with the Union Army and obtained information to help the war effort. When the time came to carry out the Combahee River raid, Tubman played a vital role. Under the cover of night on June 1st, 3 Union gunboats crept up the Combahee River. Aboard the ships were 300 black soldiers from the 2nd South Carolina Volunteer Infantry, most of whom had been enslaved on the Sea Islands. One of these men, Hector Fields, was Miss Field Black's, the author's, great-great-great-grandfather. They were joined by soldiers from the 3rd Rhode Island Heavy Artillery Regiment and officers commanded by Colonel James Montgomery, an abolitionist from Ohio. Tubman participated as a scout and a pilot. The gunboats reached their destination by morning, The soldiers disembarked and set fire to plantation houses, barns, rice mills, and harvested rice. The value of the damaged goods amounted to $23.5 million in 2022 dollars. Sighting federal ships on the river, hundreds of enslaved people raced to the shore and climbed aboard, liberating themselves in a moment of great danger. Tubman bravely left her ship and ran to the homes of the enslaved, urging them to flee to the boats. In total, 756 African-American men, women, and children gained their freedom that day. Ultimately, the Combahee River Raid was more than an act of war against the Confederacy, argues Miss Fields Black. It was also, quote, an act of creation that gave birth to freed people. During the years that followed the raid and the Confederacy surrender, these formerly enslaved African Americans built new lives by marrying, signing contracts, becoming citizens, purchasing land, and acquiring military pensions. Combahee celebrates their valor and the valor of Harriet Tubman, whose lifelong dedication to securing liberty continues to inspire us. A note on the author, Miss Bellows, is an historian and the author of the book American Slavery and Russian Serfdom in the Post-Emancipation Imagination. Still reading from the Wall Street Journal, this comes from their music review, and it was published earlier in February, another weekend edition, the 10th and the 11th. Billie Holiday was a songwriter, too. It was written by Paul Alexander. The great jazz singer drew on her troubled life to write classic songs like God Bless the Child and Lady Sings the Blues. Billie Holiday is widely considered jazz's preeminent singer. Frank Sinatra once said that, quote, with few exceptions, every major pop singer in the U.S. during her generation has been touched in some way by her genius, end quote. Her unique style, particularly her phrasing, helped change the direction of American music, giving singers permission to deliver lyrics in the personal manner that came to define not just jazz, but rock and roll and folk music. Holiday's stature has only grown in the years since her death in 1959 at the age of 44. Her signature song, the anti-lynching protest anthem, Strange Fruit, was named the Song of the Century by Time magazine in 1999. Yet Holiday's talent as a songwriter is often overlooked, even though she co-authored at least 15 songs, five of which have become jazz and blues classics. Billy's Blues, Fine and Mellow, Don't Explain, Lady Sings the Blues, and God Bless the Child. The last is her most popular song, covered by artists ranging from Aretha Franklin to Eva Cassidy to Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Holiday's unusually high success rate as a songwriter, quote, reveals a lot about the immensity of her talent, says Grammy Award-nominated singer-songwriter Lorraine Feather, whose father, Leonard, was Holiday's friend. She went on, no one sounded like her. And her songs were unique, too. All that she went through in life, a dysfunctional childhood, substance abuse, run-ins with authorities, was transformed into great art. Holiday required assistance when she wrote a song because she could neither read nor write music. She wrote her first songs under her soul byline between 1936 and 1939, when she was regularly in a studio recording singles and had plenty of musicians to help her. Fine and Mellow became a hit in part because it was the B-side to Strange Fruit, released in 1939 by Milt Gabler's Commodore Records. Gabler wrote, quote, the night before the recording session, I went down to Cafe Society. I told Billy I wanted a blues, so we sat down at a little deuce table outside of her dressing room door, and we started to write down blues verses. Billy had written and collected various blues lines, which she already had on paper. "We didn't need a tune," Gabler recalled, "because the musicians scheduled for the session, quote, all knew the blues." Gabler later claimed he wrote one verse himself, but when he filed the copyright for Fine and Mellow, he listed only Holiday as the songwriter. The song, quote, "is a mastery of storytelling and composition," says jazz artist Madeline Peru. She went on, "The melody is postmodern. The lyric is a tour de force, intimate, vulnerable, universal, and strange." In time, as Holiday recorded less frequently, she turned to co-authors to help her with her songs. Her standard method was to have an idea for a song and then, after contemplating it for days or even weeks, seek out a composer to collaborate with. Between 1939 and 41, the composer to whom she turned most often was Arthur Herzog Jr., whom she worked with on Don't Explain, one of her more personal compositions. On multiple occasions, Holiday discussed how she wrote the song's lyrics after catching her first husband, Jimmy Monroe, cheating. He came home one night with lipstick on his collar. As he fumbled for an explanation, she cut him off, saying, "Take a bath, man. Don't explain." Holiday also collaborated with Herzog on God Bless the Child. She later recalled that she got the idea for her most famous song after her mother refused to lend her money, prompting Holiday to quip, "God bless the child that's got his own." Holiday wrote, quote, "I thought about the line and thought about it. One day a whole damn song fell into place in my head. Then I rushed down to Greenwich Village that night and met with Arthur Herzog. He sat down at a piano and picked it out, phrase by phrase, as I sang to him." The song includes the lines, "Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own." A reference to Holiday's struggles with her mother, who was often flighty and childlike. Lorraine Feather says, quote, "I think Billy was being sarcastic, but there is a tender, loving vibe to the title. The lyrics are genius. Once you hear God Bless the Child, you never forget it." End quote. Following a fallow period in the mid-1940s when she struggled with drug addiction, from 1949 to 58, Holiday wrote one song on her own, Stormy Blues, and several others with collaborators, Now and Never with Curtis R. Lewis, Preacher Boy with Gene Burns, and Lady Sings the Blues with Herbie Nichols. Parentheses, Holiday added lyrics to an existing Nichols instrumental composition called Serenade and renamed it. But there is a better example of her writing process than her final song, Left Alone, which she wrote with Mal Waldron, the accomplished composer who wrote Soul Eyes, and musician who was her piano accompanist for the last 2 years of her life. In September 1958, the two of them were on a flight from New York to San Francisco, where Holiday was scheduled to perform. Waldron recalled, quote, "We had 7 hours to kill, so Billy decided she wanted to do a tune. She felt she wanted it to be the story of her life." Holiday wrote the lyrics on a piece of paper, likely with suggestions from Waldron. The title, Left Alone, reflected the perennial sadness of her life, the fact that almost all her romantic involvements ended with her being abandoned. Then, says Waldron's daughter Mala, herself a singer-songwriter, "as Billy sang the melody, my father wrote the music. He always carried manuscript paper in his briefcase. He often wrote songs and arrangements on the train. By the end of the flight, they had a song. Theirs was a true collaboration." End quote. As for Holiday as a songwriter, Mala Waldron believes, quote, "she had a natural understanding of structure, and she was a great lyricist. That one-third of her songs are classics is amazing." Perot says these compositions succeed in all the criteria of great American art, while never using a masculine voice, perspective, or tone. For a singer to write a song is to step outside one's body, turn around, and look back at oneself, then stay there as long as it takes to perfect the story. And there's no room for privacy, shame, or ambivalence. Lady Sings the Blues, God Bless the Child, Don't Explain. I believe Billie Holiday must have known how important these iconic works would be to feminism and to America, and I believe she was right. Note about this author, Paul Alexander is the author of Bitter Crop, The Heartache and Triumph of Billie Holiday's Last Year, which will be published on February 13th by Alfred A. Knopf. And that brings me to the end of our time for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. This was the Black Experience Hour.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.